All right, Erev Tov. So tonight, we're
Benjamin.
Oh, Mazel Tov to Asher Bruckner, the birth of a grandson. Okay. Tonight is part 10 of the series, The President and the Jews, and we're looking at the presidencies of Rutherford B. Hayes, James Garfield, and Chester Arthur, 1920 and 21. As you know, I hate to make mistakes. I just misspoke in 2 points last week. Not major, but just Andrew Johnson, of course, became vice president in 1865. He was Lincoln's second vice president. And Grant died in 1885. I just misspoke last week. But now that the record is clear and amended, we're sponsored again this week by Becky Navi Katz, Ilan Ishmas Yonab, and Rabbi Aryeh Leib. Grant left office amid much discontent in society. Even if he was personally popular, the South was not fully reconciled and had not embraced full freedom for blacks. But the panic of 1873 had ruined the economy, and there was real suffering, especially without the safety net that exists today. And the discord in society would be reflected in the most contentious presidential election and aftermath in history, far more than the controversies of Bush-Gore in 2000, to which the election of 1876 is often compared. And the only time in American history in which the presidency was not determined until right before inauguration, and with feeling so acrimonious, there was even a real trepidation that the president would be assassinated at the inauguration. So what happened and why, and what does all this have to do with the Jews? Ralph, I have to ask you a question after Davin, right? But Rutherford B. Hayes, the 19th president, was born in 1822 in Ohio. Sadly, he never knew his father. His father died while his mother was pregnant, but he was doted on by his mother and his only sister, Fanny, and he was very well educated, first at Kenyon College and then at Harvard Law School. He returned after law school to practice law in Ohio and was successful after a time. By coincidence, you'll see a lot of strange coincidences in American history. His partner's daughter married a gentleman named William Howard Taft, who became the 27th president. Hayes became known, in Ohio at least, after saving a few convicted murderers from the death penalty, including at least one, maybe two women who were convicted of homicide. At age 30, he married Lucy Webb. Together they had 8 children, and had a very loving, romantic relationship, as evinced through their letters. So did Grant and his wife, for that matter. Lucy was a very interesting person, strong-willed and outspoken abolitionist. He opposed slavery, but he had no desire to impose his will on the South, and Hayes did defend some fugitive slaves, and he wasn't at all averse to letting the South just go its own way and secede and become their own country. Hayes belonged to no formal religious denomination, but in fact was quite pious. She was even more pious. A night's entertainment in the Hayes family was to sit around and sing hymns, like in the Roth family also. Probably because Lucy was such a staunch temperance advocate. She was opposed to any and all drinking, and in fact she made the White House dry, alcohol-free, a stunning contrast to the Grant administration, where the liquor flowed freely, and a great disappointment to visitors and guests. Hayes' Secretary of State, William Evarts, on a White House dinner party. The water flowed like champagne. She was thus known as Lemonade Lucy, and she freaked out once when Hayes put a berry in some lemonade, which to her looked like wine. She stalked out, and Hayes had to calm her down and reassure her that no, it was just lemonade. Hayes became a minor politician in his hometown, Fremont, Ohio. He then enlisted in the army when the Civil War started, rising to become a general. William McKinley, who would be elected president exactly 20 years after Hayes, was his quartermaster that became very close, and Hayes, in fact, became a mentor to McKinley. Hayes was wounded in battle several times and was acclaimed for his leadership skills. And for this one incident, endeared himself to Jews. I referred to it briefly last or 2 weeks ago. Hayes was the commanding officer of Ohio's 23rd Regiment, and while stationed in West Virginia, remember West Virginia had seceded from Virginia just 5 days after Fort Sumter was attacked, April 1861, and admitted as a free state in 1862. So in West Virginia, Hayes allowed his Jewish soldiers to conduct the Seder, as was reported by Joseph Joel, one of his troops, in March 1866 in the Jewish Messenger. Joel told the story. 20 Jewish soldiers asked Hayes for permission, which was granted without hesitation. The soldiers had just been paid, and they ordered from Cincinnati all the necessities for Pesach. And they received on Erev Pesach 1862 seven barrels of matzos, two haggados, and some machzorim as well. And they're able to procure some cider, a lamb, several chickens, and some eggs for the two sedarim. Now, they did not have moro or karpas, but they did find some bitter weeds, which Joel wrote surpassed anything that our forefathers enjoyed, so to speak. Joseph Joel was so grateful that years later he named us his son after Hayes, Rutherford B. Hayes Joel, likely the only Jew ever named Rutherford in our history. Hayes became so well known and respected that he was elected to Congress in late 1864, but he refused to resign his commission to go to Washington, considering it disloyal to the troops under his command. Garfield will follow a similar pattern. Hayes only took his seat once the war ended. Hayes had great self-confidence. He was patient. He was very deliberate, very bright, with a patrician demeanor that belied his poor origins. Hayes, and Garfield for that matter, had fantastic beards, long and shapely, that gave them a very distinguished look, if you like beards. Do check out today's Wall Street Journal. On the op-ed page, I have an article about the disappearance of beards in public life now that Paul Ryan shaved. But it says the heyday of beards was from 1860 to 1890. And all the presidents, except for Johnson, had the extremely elaborate facial hair. But in the 20th century, I think it mentions once before, but the guy just wrote a book on it, of all things. The guy wrote the article in the journal. In the 20th century, beards are or any type of facial hair is considered threatening to women. It's like an assertion of masculinity that women do not like. The last president to have facial hair was Taft, and the last candidate was Thomas Dewey, and there's already recorded that women were turned off to him because of a very thin mustache that he had. But Hayes and Garfield, they're at the top of the list of presidential beards. In Congress, Hayes supported the 14th Amendment, supported more civil rights for blacks, and he grew to oppose Andrew Johnson. He left Congress to run for governor of Ohio, was elected governor in 1867, winning by less than 3,000 votes out of almost 500,000 cast. Hayes enthusiastically supported the state bill in Ohio giving blacks the right to vote, which the Democrats vehemently opposed. Hayes said, honest colored men are preferable to white traitors. That's one way to put it. He won. It was very close, and Hayes would become familiar with close elections. In 1868, he supported Grant and took it upon himself in 1868 to campaign in the Jewish community, win them back for the Republicans. Recall from last week how Grant had offended Jews. And it was as governor of Ohio that Grant became a candidate for president in 1876. For whatever reason, Ulysses Grant disliked Hayes. The teetotaling probably had something to do with it. And there are other candidates who are better known and more popular than Hayes. Roscoe Conkling, we'll refer to him later as well. Grant had nominated him to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Cockling declined, remained in the Senate, and his other job, which he earned much more money, we'll see in a moment. And James G. Blaine, the Senator of Maine. Now, Blaine was the author of the famous Blaine Amendment that affects us until today, even though it didn't become federal law. The Blaine Amendment was an attempt to weaken Catholicism in America, and Blaine proposed that no public funds can be used to support sectarian schools. It didn't pass. It didn't become a constitutional amendment, but 38 states have adopted it nonetheless, including in some form New York and New Jersey, and that's the reason why yeshivas have to beg for books, for milk, for bus service, etc. The measure was supported by Grant and Hayes and Garfield and Arthur, but it garnered Blaine the Protestant support that he was seeking. So Blaine was the favorite, and he had a strong majority on the first ballot, or strong plurality, but he did have a majority of the delegates. Hayes crept up on the outside, with Conkling eventually throwing a support to Hayes on the seventh ballot. Hayes was elected. He prevailed, or elected as the nominee of the Republicans. Congressman William Wheeler of New York was nominated as vice president. One of the great statements. Hayes, I'm ashamed to say, who is Wheeler? He didn't know the vice presidential nominee. Hayes opposed New York's Governor Samuel Tilden, the third time in a row. A New Yorker would run against an Ohioan and lose, much like the Knicks and the Cavaliers today. But Tilden defeated Hayes by more than 250,000 votes, a quarter of a million votes. In the Electoral College, though, Tilden only garnered 184 votes, which was one vote shy of the 185 needed for victory. Hayes had 165, and there were 20 electoral votes in dispute that would have to be allocated and would determine the election. This was uncharted waters. It was unlike 1824. We were four candidates, and simply no one had a majority, so the election fell to the House of Representatives. There, at least, all electors were accounted for. Here, the 20 votes, electoral votes, were in dispute, coming from three southern states, Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina, and a couple from Oregon. And in the southern states, there were allegations of fraud by both sides, and there were no allegations. There was actually quite extensive evidence of the deprivation of black votes, or the blacks of their right to vote in the South. There were cases where they simply took ballots of blacks and threw them away by the thousands. It was a mess. So how do you determine the dispensation of those 20 electoral votes? Well, both parties decided to form a commission without any constitutional authority at all, composed of an equal number of Republicans and Democrats from Congress, 5 and 5, and 5 Supreme Court justices, 2 and 2, Republican, Democrat, and 1 perceived as an independent. They met over the course of several months, around elections in November. The president was not sworn until March. He ruled along party lines, 8-7, to award all 20 electoral votes to Hayes, allowing him to squeak through, 185-184. The Democrats were apoplectic. They had won a majority in the House because the South was now solidly Democratic. These Democrats were mainly racist Confederate holdovers. So the Democrats decided they would challenge Hayes in the House. Filibuster, unless their demands were met. They made 2 basic demands. First, the removal of all federal troops from the South and more economic aid. And that deal went through. Even if it's arguable how much Hayes knew about it, it was finalized on March 2nd, 1877, and the Democrats acquiesced to the election of Rutherford B. Hayes. Hayes was sworn in the next day, March 3rd, which was a Shabbos, because he would not consent to being sworn in on Sunday the 4th, which was his Sabbath. So he became president by 1 vote. Most held it was legitimate. because of the destruction of black votes, some never accepted his election, referring to him not as his excellency, but as his fraudulency. In fact, there's a book on the 1876 election that's entitled His Fraudulency, and Hayes himself, people called him Rutherford B. Hayes instead of Rutherford. They were very clever back then. One New York paper headlined after the inauguration, Mr. Hayes is not president. Like in 2000, Florida was critical to the outcome, and President Bush prevailed with just one electoral vote beyond the minimum 270 required. He beat Gore 271 to 266 with the electoral votes from Florida. Well, Hayes took office amid this controversy, and he had an underrated presidency. He was widely admired for his honesty, his intelligence, his simplicity, his fairness, his humility, and his military and administrative records. The New York Times even compared him favorably to Abraham Lincoln. But with the withdrawal of all federal troops from the South, that was the agreement, Reconstruction ended, as did much of the protection for Southern blacks, as did, for that matter, the blacks' ability to vote unfettered. It would not be long before the Jim Crow laws dominated the South, and with the loss of the black vote, they just didn't allow them to vote in large numbers, the Democrats became the majority party in the South for almost 100 years, the party of racists. Hayes tried to reconcile, tried to unite, and he appointed many Democrats to patronage positions, angering Republicans, but just because he thought it was fair and the right thing to do. It was Hayes who coined the famous slogan, now gathering dust, he who serves his party best, who serves his country best. He even appointed Frederick Douglass, the black abolitionist, the marshal in the District of Columbia, which really antagonized, scandalized the racists. So his appointments did tick off a lot of people. One of them was Simon Wolfe, that great Jewish supporter of Lincoln and Grant. So Grant had appointed Wolfe the recorder of deeds in the District of Columbia. It doesn't sound like much, but all these jobs paid real money and got you all the money through clients and contacts. So he stayed on until 1878 when Hayes asked for his resignation. Wolfe was irritated and he wrote to Hayes that he knows why he was fired. He made the mistake of supporting Hayes in 1876, and he's being punished for it. For no doubt, had I opposed you, I might have been elected to the cabinet, which is very good sarcasm on Simon Wolfe's part. It was Hayes who sent, we mentioned this last week, Hayes sent Benjamin Franklin Peixoto, Jew, who had been Grant's consul in Bucharest, watching over Romanian Jewry. Hayes sent him to St. Petersburg, Russia, for similar reasons, but the Jew-hating Tsar Alexander II rejected him. Jews were barred from living in St. Petersburg, the last thing the Tsar would want. Remember, St. Petersburg was the capital then of Russia. The last thing he wanted was actually a Jew representing America, and so Hayes just sent Peixoto to Lyon, France instead. Hayes did intervene again on behalf of Romanian Jewry when they were subjected to pogroms and persecution, saying, I quote, "This government has ever felt deep interest in the welfare of the Hebrew race in foreign countries and has viewed with abhorrence the wrongs to which they have at various periods been subjected by followers of other creeds in the East." Hayes also intervened to help an American Jew, Henry Pincus, I guess his name was Pincus, who had gone to St. Petersburg with his wife and child to live for a time and to do business, thinking that Jews may not be allowed to live in St. Petersburg, Russian Jews, but shouldn't apply to American Jews. Well, Pincus got the same treatment. He and his family were expelled from St. Petersburg. They appealed to the American consul. Secretary of State Evarts asked that they be treated like any other American, based on 1832 treaty between the U.S. and Russia, because they're Americans, not because they're Jews. Well, it didn't have a happy ending. Pincus was given 3 months to sell his business, But after 3 months, the Russians invalidated his passport and confiscated his money. So he had to actually ask for tzedakah from the Jews there to leave, try to make it back to America. And he was supported that way. He left saying, Russia is no place for one of my creed. Would that millions of other Jews had realized that as well when Pinchas did. Hayes, interestingly enough, was also the very first president to guarantee the rights of Shomrei Shabbos in federal appointment, and he personally intervened with the Department of the Interior to protect a female Jewish employee. She refused to work on Shabbos. They tried to fire her. Hayes said that anyone who would rather give up a job than violate the Sabbath was a good citizen and even more worthy of the job itself. Hayes became a regular traveler in the U.S., which was rare, visiting parts of the country, quite uncommon for president in the 19th century, and he was popular with the people, but the attacks on Hayes's legitimacy never ceased. It would recur constantly in his administration. One fall, the New York Sun lamented that Hayes was not Jewish, for if he were, he would have to seek atonement for his fraud on Yom HaKippurim. But that also shows you how much Jewish culture had already seeped into the public domain, even if just in New York City. Hayes is not construed as a great president, mostly because he did not face any great crisis like a war, and he served by his own choice only one term. But even if he did not fully solve the southern problem, no one could. It was pacified, and there was less unrest, and his conservative economic policies slowly reversed the effects of the Panic of 1873. And his administration was praised for its integrity, that itself no small feat. Hayes heralded a new order of civil service reform. We could not implement any changes, and that would spark the controversies of the next president and even the death of the next president. After leaving office, Hayes retired to his estate at Spiegel Grove in Ohio. He was despondent after the death of his beloved Lucy in 1889, and he died much admired in 1893. Hayes' legacy of limiting the spoil system, or attempting to, and making political appointments based on merit shaped the presidential career of his successor, James Garfield. And already in Hayes' administration, the Republican Party had split into two factions. It's like today, but they had greater names than we had. The two factions were the Stalwarts, led by the aforementioned Roscoe Conkling of New York, and the Half-Breeds, led by the aforementioned Senator James Blaine. What do we have today? Tea Party, Socialist. I mean, all these things are rehashed from the past. The Stalwarts believed a tremendous emunah in patronage, in the power of the ruling party to hand out jobs and perks to its supporters. And it's from this that Roscoe Conkling was the power in New York, and in patronage even beyond New York, and made a lot of money that way. So as such, they opposed Hayes, and they nominated Grant for a third term in 1880 because they found him to be very malleable, very easily manipulated. Conkling was a real force, and he made a fortune off the bribes and kickbacks that he could receive. No wonder he turned down the appointment as Chief Justice and stayed in the Senate. The half-breeds favored civil service reform and the distribution of federal jobs based on merits, a novel concept. It should be noted that dispensing patronage jobs was one of the busiest jobs of any president. Once a president took office, he'd be besieged by people lining up outside and inside the White House seeking audiences and jobs. You know, the White House used to be completely open to the public because it was a public premises. You could just walk in. There are times Lincoln would leave his bedroom in the morning, his bedroom, and find job seekers lined up in the hall waiting to see him. So half-breeds were called half-breeds because they were half loyal to Grant and half loyal to reform. They wanted to change the system in some as yet ambiguous way. The two factions were deeply divided. Grant fell short several times in winning a majority at their convention in 1880. Blaine was even more distant on the 36th ballot, the longest convention ever, 7 days. On the 36th ballot, the party nominated a consensus compromise candidate, the dark horse, James Garfield. He would become the 20th president, the second to be assassinated in office, serving the second shortest stint of any president, just 4 months before he was shot, 6 before he died. But Garfield was an impressive personality also, with an illustrious, colorful resume and personality, and like I mentioned before, fantastic beard as well. Garfield was born in 1831 in Ohio. He was the last president born in a log cabin. He was poor. His father died when he was just 2 years old. He was raised by his mother, became a bookworm, a voracious reader. One of his favorites already as a young child was The Jewish Wars by Josephus. And to his mother's horror, he left home at age 16 to ride the barge on the Ohio canals. He was admittedly somewhat klutzy, and he says he fell overboard no less than 14 times, almost drowned a few times. And when he caught malaria after one spill, he decided to return home and resume his schooling. That he did. Taught himself Greek and Latin. One of his dinner party talents, he could write Greek and Latin simultaneously with each hand. He became a math prodigy. Even more importantly, he taught himself public speaking, became one of the great orators of his day, an ordained preacher as well. To earn money, he taught in a local school when he was in college, replacing the previous teacher, none other than Chester A. Arthur, who later became his vice president. Garfield was tall and handsome, cut a very striking figure. Could leave an audience spellbound. He was tall and blue-eyed, gregarious, warm, outgoing, a natural leader, really not like Hayes. He was a lifelong foe of slavery, became a lawyer and an effective one, and was also very ambitious. He said, "When I am sitting, I long to be walking. And when I am walking, I long to be sitting." And he would parlay that ambition very shrewdly into the presidency. He married Lucretia, called a Crete, in 1858. Had 5 children. Garfield suffered from persistent rumors of womanizing, rumors that his letters to Lucretia do not substantially refute. He was apologetic in them. But they stayed together and apparently straightened out over time. In 1861, Garfield was among those who felt there was no way to avoid a civil war, to keep the Union together, and he longed to join the fighting. He studied military strategy, ancient wars, and was asked and granted a commission as a lieutenant colonel. And he rose to be a general in his Ohio regiment. He was courageous in battle, already well known. And from the battlefield, he was elected to Congress at Lincoln's request. In 1862, he too refused to leave the battlefield, as Congress would not meet until a year and a month later, December 1863. But during the campaign, on a visit to Washington, he was befriended and even adopted in a way by Salmon P. Chase, the former Ohio governor, Lincoln's Treasury Secretary and future Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And Chase became Garfield's mentor and really surrogate father as well. Garfield would serve 9 terms in the House, and he became one of the radical Republicans who considered Lincoln too moderate and Johnson too weak. Garfield was unequivocal in his support of black voting rights, and Garfield was also utilized to try to straighten out the 1876 election mess. He was one of the 15 on the commission that ultimately ruled in favor of Hayes. He disagreed with Hayes' patronage appointments, but he was not openly aligned with either stalwarts or half-breeds, and that served him well. In the election of 1880, as Grant and Blaine fought it out, Garfield stayed in the background, endorsed a third person, the Secretary of Treasury, John Sherman, William Tecumseh Sherman's brother. And it was a brilliant stroke. Sherman never garnered that much support, had no traction, but Garfield's oratory on his behalf galvanized the crowd. He was so electrifying when he spoke. He gave a pro-Sherman speech, and when he finished, the people started screaming, "Garfield, Garfield, Garfield." That's what they wanted. And on the 36th ballot, he was nominated. So he was seen by the stalwarts as a half-breed. So the Republicans sought to balance the ticket by nominating a stalwart for vice president. And that turned out to be Chester A. Arthur, who had never served in any political capacity before. But he had the ultimate patronage job. He was the collector of customs for the port of New York. So his job had a nice salary for the time, but when you add to it kickbacks and bribes, he was earning well over $50,000 a year, more than 25, maybe even 30 times what the average worker earned. And the staff, and he also received a percentage when they discovered smuggled goods or untaxed goods. And Arthur was Roscoe Conkling's man. Garfield didn't know him well. He hated his politics. And soon the two men would not be on speaking terms. Even as vice president, Arthur would give interviews to newspapers denouncing his president Garfield, even calling him a liar. After the squeaker of 1876, as hard as it is to imagine, this election was even closer, at least in the popular vote. Garfield defeated a Civil War general, Winfield Scott Hancock, the hero of Gettysburg, by about 9,000 votes out of 9 million cast. 48.27% to 48.25%, the closest election ever. The Electoral College margin was wider, 214 to 155, so Garfield took office without the controversy that had bedeviled Hayes. Just 10 days after Garfield took office, Tsar Alexander II was assassinated. Jews had nothing to do with it, but 3 months of pogroms ensued. Hundreds of Jewish women were raped, dozens killed, and the American consul in St. Petersburg reported that the suffering of the Jews, I quote, is painful to contemplate. He reported that you have 5 million Jews clamoring to be freed from all the special restrictions imposed on them, whereas the other 85 million Russians were clamoring to have those 5 million expelled from the empire. Rabble-rousing the peasants against the Jews was always a successful tactic, still is. Garfield denounced the pogroms, but without much effect. Now, aside from the continuing fight over patronage and spoils and the feud between the stalwarts and the half-breeds, really not much was going on. Garfield received death threats even before he took office because of these feuds, and he wrote to Sherman, "Assassination can be no more guarded against than death by lightning, and it's best not to worry about either." Well, he should have worried a little more. There was one pesky job applicant that was besieging the White House and the State Department for months already. His name was Charles Guiteau. He got nothing. He wanted to be the consul to Paris, a little off, and he grew steadily more aggrieved, and he boiled over when the Secretary of State, James Blaine, ordered him not to show up anymore at the State Department. So he determined to kill Garfield, and he began stalking him, especially as the newspapers printed Garfield's daily schedule. July 2nd, 1881, just 4 months after taking office, Garfield's going to travel to New Jersey to meet his wife for the July 4th holiday. Garfield waited with Blaine at the D.C. train station, not the Baltimore and Ohio, I forget the name, but it's today where the National Gallery of Art is located on the National Mall. That's where the train station was. Guiteau just walked up to him. Think about it. It's inconceivable today. The president is just standing next to the Secretary of State, just the two of them chatting at the train station. Guiteau walked up to Garfield, shot him twice. One bullet grazed his arm, but the second broke a rib and lodged in his abdomen. Blaine recognized the assassin immediately. Guiteau said this, "I did it and will go to jail for it. I am a stalwart and Arthur will be president." Well, that didn't really help Arthur that much. Guiteau was arrested, tried, convicted, and executed a year later. Now, Garfield's treatment is itself controversial. One biographer of Garfield is a fellow named Dr. Ira Rutko, who's a surgeon at UMDNJ, and he says today Garfield's injuries would not even be life-threatening, that he'd be released from the hospital within 2 days, but medicine was very primitive back then. Even worse, a series of doctors stuck their unsterilized fingers into Garfield's wound for weeks, trying to locate the bullet, and instead they infected him. And it was of that infection that he died in September. He was mourned. He was buried in the Lakeview Cemetery in Cleveland. So there's there's a Cleveland listener on the internet to these lectures, Rabbi David Farkas. He wrote to me that Garfield is buried on the edge of the stately Reformed Jewish Cemetery in Cleveland, right near the fence, and right near the graves of the tycoon John D. Rockefeller and the crime buster Elliot Ness. How's that for good trivia? I thank him for that. Lucretia was 49 when James died. Garfield was only 50. And she was widowed for 36 years until her death in 1918, just a few months after the Balfour Declaration was issued. Garfield wasn't in office long enough to have much of an impact on Jewish life, but he did appoint that gadfly Simon Wolf as consul to Egypt, signed the paper July 1st, just the day before he was shot. And Garfield was very well aware of the imagery in appointing a Jew to that Egyptian post, and he compared Simon Wolf to Yosef, saying to Wolf, "I am happy to name a descendant of a people who had been enslaved by the Egyptians as a representative to that country from a great free land. There is still a God in Israel." That was Garfield's message to Simon Wolf. Garfield's death, due to the inferior medical care he received, led one prominent local Jew, we've encountered him before, Adolphus Solomons, who was a Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Mitzvahs, the printing company had printed the invitations to Lincoln's inaugural. Solomons proposed and contributed substantially to the District of Columbia's very first hospital. It's hard to imagine, they never had a hospital before this. Named the Garfield Memorial Hospital, Solomons was instrumental in founding it, along with an even more famous woman, the nurse Clara Barton. Now, in truth, Hayes and Garfield and Arthur all had a role in the Blaine Amendment that I mentioned, but Jews were not feared as much as Catholics were feared. There was a sense, once Catholic immigration started, really the 1840s, that Catholics could never be loyal to America. They had a direct pipeline, I guess called the Pope line, direct pipeline to the Pope, and they'd always be more loyal to the Pope. So we're accustomed to the dual loyalty accusation in our world, but the fact is Catholics suffered from it first, and I guess the country made their peace with Catholics. Jews are still subject to that on occasion. In any event, with Garfield's death, Chester Alan Arthur became the 21st president. He had a very difficult adjustment, and not only because of what Guiteau had offered as his motive to try to get Arthur to be the president, it was primarily because Arthur was not a politician. He had never run for any elective office. Also, unimaginable. Could you imagine a guy running for president today never having even run for any office before? Could that ever happen? Nah, of course not. So before he was nominated for vice president, he had never stood for election anywhere, and he was perceived as an amiable lightweight. The typical reaction once people realized that Garfield was dead: Chet Arthur, president of the United States, good God. But he surprised many people, as much as he himself was surprised to become vice president and then president. Arthur was born in Vermont in 1829. His father was a Baptist preacher, an itinerant preacher, moved around a bit. So in fact, Arthur grew up and his whole life was associated with New York, lived in upstate New York most of his life, except when he came to the city. He went to college, his early years were in upstate New York, went to college, became a lawyer, and was always a bon vivant. He was the only president to sport mutton chop whiskers. Like Walt Frazier used to have that also, without the beard. long sideburns and just a mustache, but nothing on the chin. Only such president to have that. He knew how to live. He also made a nice living from his civil service job. He lived well, and when he achieved his dream job, he would host or attend fancy dinners every night, trying to make contacts. He married his love, Ellen Nell, when he was 30. Their oldest child, unfortunately, died age 2 of brain disease. They had 2 other children, but really what saddened him, Ellen died in 1880, age 42 of pneumonia. So in fact, Arthur was devastated. He never remarried. His widowhood played a role in his being nominated in 1880. Really, he was looking for something to do, so she never got to see him be the vice president or the president. At an early age, Arthur latched on to this Roscoe Conkling, and Conkling's power rested in his ability to dispense jobs. So Arthur was really the power behind the scenes because of his friendly nature and his love of good food, wine, cigars. It was through Conkling that Arthur became the collector of customs in New York, earning more than the president at the time. He was a good manager, and today we would say he had great people skills. He was not from the hard workers. Then, even as president, he would never arrive before 10 and never stay after 5, and he would take time off for lunch. It's a good job, but the money rolled in. And it was this spoil system, the distribution of jobs through patronage. You know, it's not what you know, but who you know, which was more important than what you could do. That became the great issue in the United States at this time, the divide between the stalwarts and the half-breeds, and would define American political life at a time when the country was growing and prospering. So Arthur was a Conkling underling, was a stalwart. He came to prominence, actually, when Hayes sacked him as the collector of customs for no good reason. Hayes was looking to stick it to Conkling. He became a stalwart hero, and in the complicated election of 1880, the battle between the half-breeds and the stalwarts led to the compromised dark horse candidate Garfield, and Arthur was chosen in order to pacify the stalwart wing and help Garfield win New York. It was assumed that Republicans could not win the South, and in fact they did not. They needed almost every state in the North. Interestingly, Conkling ordered his protege not to accept the nomination as vice president. Obviously, it would give his protege more power than he had, and for the first time, but not the last, Arthur asserted himself, and he defied Conkling, who pouted. He sat out the campaign, hoping they would lose, and within a year, in a huff, resigned from the Senate not to be reelected by the legislature. Arthur's nomination as vice president was derided as ridiculous burlesque, a miserable farce. He had never run for any office, even his Civil War service, who's a brigadier general, was as a quartermaster. He never left New York, never saw combat. It was after this, after he became president, many newspapers called for future conventions to pay closer attention to who was nominated for vice president. When Garfield was shot, Arthur was in New York. They hadn't spoken already. There were loggerheads for a few months, but Arthur, in fact, was very subdued, very depressed, and crushed when Garfield was shot. They'd had a falling out. He feared he'd be blamed for the death, but he was also perceived as the ultimate patronage appointee, completely unqualified for the job. But he exceeded expectations and overcame partisanship. Even rebuffed Conkling when Conkling asked for a plum cabinet position, like Treasury. And Arthur brought to Washington a sense of order, style, even fun. His daughter served as the First Lady. He refused to move into the White House until it was modernized and renovated. They threw out or auctioned furniture that today would be considered priceless antiques. They just threw it out, wanted new stuff. And Arthur became a regular on the banquet circuit, and his job hours never changed either. Well, in the midterm elections of 1882, the Republicans were creamed, with the Democrats outnumbering Republicans in Congress now by 2-1. and the Republicans barely held on to the Senate, to the horror of Conkling, the demand for civil service reform had become bipartisan because of some of the scandals of the 1870s and intensified after Garfield was assassinated. Arthur surprised everyone by signing the Pendleton Civil Service Act, reforming the civil service to mandate appointments based on merit. And this is a watershed moment in American history as it opened up the political system to the general public more than ever before. And civil servants had to see themselves as serving the public and not the party. The bureaucracy would now serve the people, not just the wealthy and the elites, and even that did not happen overnight. Major changes always require decades to take root. As time went on, Arthur began to work even less, leading some to ridicule him. But now we know he was diagnosed with Bright's disease, specifically, Dr. Katz will help me, glomerulonephritis. I knew it was something like that. It's a kidney disorder that debilitated him and would kill him within a few years. He was simply too fatigued to work. And remember, he didn't have a vice president serving under him, just like Johnson had not, and just like Tyler had not. But Arthur presided over an America without crisis. The government ran an annual surplus of $100 million. Nothing today, but then it was a lot of money. But he too had no constituency, and he knew he had little chance of being elected in his own right. He built up America's army and navy, which had been neglected. Arthur presided over the dedication of the Brooklyn Bridge, May 24th, 1883, which linked the two cities and eventually led Brooklyn to becoming part of New York City in 1898. Remember, Brooklyn was its own city for a long time. And during his term, in a fateful decision, the Supreme Court struck down the Civil Rights Act of 1875, ruling that blacks were now mere citizens and could be subject to the whims, injustices, and prejudices of anyone, just like any other citizen. If you didn't like a black, you could refuse them service, like to a Jew, a Catholic, a Protestant, an Indian, or anyone else. Well, this created the racial caste system in the South, which would take a century at least to undo. Arthur appealed to Congress for new legislation, but he was ignored. Now, Arthur also knew his share of Jews, befriending the ubiquitous Simon Wolfe, as other presidents before him. When the International Red Cross was founded, Clara Barton became the president of the American Red Cross, and Adolphus Solomons, that Shomer Shabbos, was the vice president, and Arthur appointed both of them as the American delegates to the International Red Cross Congress in Geneva. And he too was confronted with the reality of Jew hatred in Russia, protesting the treatment of American Jews who went to do business there. Arthur was troubled that they are treated as poorly as are Russian Jews, and that such violates the U.S.-Russian treaty, just like Hayes had protested. And he lamented that there's no reason to believe that at any time in the near future, Russia will tolerate all faiths within its borders. And he was right about that. December 4th, 1882. Our long-established friendliness with Russia has prompted me to proffer the earnest counsels of this government that measures be adopted for suppressing the proscription which the Hebrew race in that country has lately suffered. Well, that too was ignored by the Tsar. He was the first president to preside over the wave of European, especially Jewish immigration, which began in 1881. The fear in America then was not of Jewish immigration, but it was of Chinese immigration. And Arthur, in fact, against his better judgment, signed the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 into law. He had vetoed one such bill. He signed this more moderate version, a 10-year instead of a 20-year exclusion, even though in principle he was against any limitation, but he knew if he vetoed it, it would just be overridden. People feared the loss of jobs, especially on the West Coast. And remember that immigrant assistance then was all local and private. The federal government played no role. And it's probably a coincidence, but the first steamship company to travel between New York and the land of Israel, the American Palestine Company, founded in 1924, owned and operated by Jews, their very first ship was the SS President Arthur. It's probably a coincidence. Now, just as well that Arthur did not run for office in 1884, although his name was in nomination at the convention, James G. Blaine would be the candidate, and he would end the streak of Republicans winning 6 consecutive elections, the most ever. Arthur is the last sitting president not to be renominated by his own party, and it is just as well. Arthur would die of kidney disease in November 1886. He never would have lived out the term. He was only 57 years old, buried up in Albany, New York. Now, Arthur, like Hayes and Garfield, were men without prejudice. And in fact, they were underappreciated presidents. They're not like the mediocrities of the 1850s that we discussed. They're good men who accomplished some good things and did very few bad things, but they lived in an era lacking the crises that elevate men to the ranks of the great presidents, and also serving in an era where Congress exercised greater authority and could accomplish more than the president. And Arthur left office to extensive praise for Mark Twain and others. And Twain never had good words about anybody, but he praised Arthur for the conduct of his administration. All their reputations, though, would fade over time. Their successors would confront similar issues, some new ones, and Jews would continue to grow in numbers and prominence. And subsequent presidents would deal with a new phenomenon that began in the 1880s as well, the rise of Zionism and the return to Zion. That we'll discuss next time. Next week we'll look at the presidencies of Grover Cleveland, Itzi's man, and Benjamin Harrison. I thank you all very much.